White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
How are you? Terrible Tommy here in the bunker again, and it's 20 degrees this morning here in North Chile, Indiana. How about that? It's also, well, it's not quite that chilly at P.O. Box 401. We can still get the door unlocked and get the donations out of there, so it's not too cold in the post office. So let's get at it and get them in there, and we'll put it to work, man, I'll tell you. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Well, I hear everybody talking about how this country's all split up. They can't figure it out. They got to figure out how to get it back together. Well, one reason it's split up is because we've got, 30, 40 million mestizos in here? Totally new people? Then we got more and more blacks. The whole country's divided because it's racially divided, and that's what the ruling class set out to do, and now they're griping. Now you hear all of them saying, I can't understand it. This country is all split up. We got to unify and get back together. So we got to bring in more of these people from overseas, and we got to welcome the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans and all of them in here. And then we can get back together and be one big happy family. Well, that isn't going to happen. How stupid could they be? You divide the country into racial nations, and then you want to bring them back together into one nation? Ain't going to happen. No way, no how. They want diversity? Well, they've got diversity. Quit crying about it.
A giant reportedly became the hate crimes that have been sweeping through the tri-state area. Wednesday, CBS New York reported that Nikita Whitlock's home had been broken into and vandalized the night earlier, and the alleged intruders had scrawled racist messages all over the walls. The 25-year-old Whitlock, who spent the entire season on injured reserve, came home to a graffiti swastika, KKK, and go back to Africa messages scrawled on the walls inside his home. His wife, Ashley Whitlock, said, "It's very disgusting, actually. It's very disheartening." Whitlock said he, his wife, and their two children were gone for only a few hours, then returned to see their apartment ransacked. He added, "Oppression, violence, racism, hatred, violence, there's no need for that."
Well, his football player is all upset because he has found out there may be racism in his house. They showed pictures of this. They showed swastikas and other racial comments painted on the inside of his house. But they also showed a white arm and with gloves on with a crowbar breaking into the house. Now, since there's been no arrests, how do we know who did this? Because, one, it could be, as they say, some terrible white person has marked his territory in the football player's house. Or it could be that blacks or other non-whites got in the house and did the same thing just to achieve a goal of theirs. Or the football player has been sidelined. He hasn't been too active on the football field. Maybe he is pumping up this stuff by himself. You may see him get arrested. But racism's alive and well, and it's always going to be. It's going to get wilder and wilder. And there'll be a little downslide to it sometimes and think it's all is lost and the white race has had it. But I don't think so. I think that we may have to go through a couple of generations of going downhill, but then I think we're going to pop up on the other side and be a mean machine again. Make our race great again. How about that? Well, boys and girls, I'm going to run a lengthy article here for you, convert it to audio. And one of the reasons I'm running it for is because your friends and compadres were involved in exposing this Iran-Contra narcotics program. Most of the guys that were involved in this, I believe, were operating with the Aryan Nations, and I got to know about it, that this Contra drug thing was run through MENA Airport down in Arkansas with the blessings of Bill Clinton, even though a lot of the people involved were Republicans. Everybody was making money off of it. And they were landing CIA planes there in MENA Airport, downloading the narcotics, and then taking them out to primarily the inner cities, to where they were pushing them into the hands of the blacks. And that, of course, that information's been around for quite a while now, but it's definitely true. And a man by the name of Richard Snell, who was operating, I believe, connected to Aryan Nations, had staked out that airport and was taking pictures and so forth through the chain link fence of everything that was going on. Later, he was set up and given a death penalty, and the night that the Marat building blew up in Arkansas was the same time that Snell was executed. So there's a lot of information here and a lot of information behind the scenes that's tied to this major war criminal activity by Reagan and all the boys, and what's his name? Of course, none of the people involved ever went to prison. Oliver North is paraded around as a big hero of the conservative right when he should have been in prison from the very beginning, probably life in prison for the number of people that he caused the death of in Central America when this government got itself involved in the Nicaraguan situation, which was none of their business at all, except business and the corporations and so forth. Nicaragua had every right to choose whatever form of government it wanted. And on the pretext of fighting communism is how we got involved. In fact, going back in my history, I see now that so much of my occupied time was involved in going along with this. They're bad because they're supposedly communist. So here we go. It's a long one, but I think you will be glad you heard it. It's me reiterating that your government is crooked, it's rotten, it has nothing to do with what the white race should be doing.
Big Media's Contra Cocaine Cover-Up December 9, 2016 Special Report. 12 years ago, a campaign of character assassination by the major of the United States newspapers drove an honest journalist to suicide. Now those papers claim to be paragons of truth-telling, says Robert Perry. By Robert Perry, amid the mainstream the United States media's current self-righteous frenzy against fake news, it's worth recalling how the big newspapers destroyed Gary Webb, an honest journalist who exposed some hard truths about the Reagan administration's collaboration with Nicaraguan Contra cocaine traffickers. Webb's reward for reviving that important scandal in 1996 and getting the CIA's Inspector General to issue what amounted to an institutional confession in 1998 was to have the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times lobby for, essentially, his banishment from journalism. The major media pile-on was so intense and so effective that Webb lost his job at the San Jose Mercury News and could never find regular work in his profession again. Betrayed by his journalistic colleagues, his money gone, his family broken and his life seemingly hopeless, Webb committed suicide on December 9, 2004. Even then, the Los Angeles Times wrote up his obituary as if the paper were telling the life story of an organized crime boss, not a heroic journalist. The Times obit was then republished by the Washington Post. In other words, on one of the most significant scandals of the Reagan era, major newspapers, which now want to serve as the arbiters of truth for the Internet, demonstrated how disdainful they actually are toward truth when it puts the United States government in a harsh light. Indeed, if it had been up to the big newspapers, this important chapter of modern history would never have been known. A decade earlier, in 1985, Brian Barger and I first exposed the contra-cocaine connection for the Associated Press, and we watched as the big papers turned their backs on the scandal then, too. The main point that Webb added to the story was how some of the contra-cocaine fed into the production of crack cocaine that had such a devastating effect on America's black communities in particular. Webb's disclosure of the crack connection infuriated many African Americans, and the big papers acted as if it was their civic duty to calm down those inner-city folks by assuring them that the United States government would never do such a thing. So, instead of doing their jobs as journalists, the major newspapers acted as the last line of defense against the people learning the truth. A solid record yet. What's remarkable now about the contra-cocaine scandal is that despite the cover-up efforts of the big papers, the truth is out there, available in official government documents, including the CIA's Inspector General's report. Collectively, the information also represents a damning indictment of the New York Times, the Washington Post and Los Angeles Times, and demonstrates why they are unfit to lecture anyone about what's real and what's fake. For instance, in 2013, at the National Archives Annex in College Park, Maryland, I discovered a declassified secret, the United States Law Enforcement report that detailed how top Contra leader Adolfo Calero was casually associating with Norwin Menezes, described in the records as a well-reputed drug dealer. Menezes was near the center of Webb's 1996 articles for the San Jose Mercury News. The report was typical of the evidence that the Reagan administration and the big newspapers chose to ignore. It recounted information from Dennis Ainsworth, a blue-blood Republican from San Francisco who volunteered to help the Contra cause in 1984-85. That put him in position to witness the strange goings-on of Contra leaders hobnobbing with drug traffickers and negotiating arms deals with White House emissaries. Ainsworth also was a source of mine in fall 1985 when I was investigating the mysterious channels of funding for the Contras after Congress shut off CIA support in 1984 amid widespread reports of Contra atrocities inflicted on Nicaraguan civilians, including rapes, executions, and torture. Ainsworth's first-hand knowledge of the Contra dealings dovetailed with information that I already had, such as the central role of National Security Council aide Oliver North in aiding the Contras and his use of courier Rob Owen as an off-the-books White House intermediary to the Contras. I later developed confirmation of some other details that Ainsworth described, such as his overhearing Owen and Calero working together on an arms deal as Ainsworth drove them through the streets of San Francisco. As for Ainsworth's knowledge about the contra-cocaine connection, he said he sponsored a June 1984 cocktail party at which Calero spoke to about 60 people. Menezes, a notorious drug kingpin in the Nicaraguan community, showed up uninvited and clearly had a personal relationship with Calero, who was then the political leader of the Contras' chief fighting force, the CIA-backed Nicaraguan Democratic Force, or FDN. At the end of the cocktail party, Menezes and Calero went off together, Ainsworth told the United States Attorney Joseph P. Russoniello, according to a secret January 6, 1987 cable submitted by Russoniello to an FBI investigation codenamed Front Door, a probe into the Reagan administration's corruption. After Calero's speech, Ainsworth said Menezes accompanied Calero and about 20 people to dinner and picked up the entire tab, according to a more detailed debriefing of Ainsworth by the FBI. Concerned about this relationship, Ainsworth said he was told by Renato Pina, an FDN leader in the San Francisco area, that the FDN is involved in drug smuggling with the aid of Norwin Menezes, who also buys arms for Enrique Bermudez, a leader of the FDN. Bermudez was then the top Contra military commander. Corroborating account Pina, who himself was convicted on federal drug charges in 1984, gave a similar account to the Drug Enforcement Administration. According to a 1998 report by the Justice Department's Inspector General Michael Bromwich, when debriefed by the DEA in the early 1980s, Pina said that the CIA was allowing the Contras to fly drugs into the United States, sell them, and keep the proceeds. Pina stated that he was present on many occasions when Menezes telephoned Bermudez in Honduras. Menezes told Pina of Bermudez's requests for such things as gun silencers, which Pina said Menezes obtained in Los Angeles, crossbows and other military equipment for the Contras. Pina believed that Menezes would sometimes transport certain of these items himself to Central America, and other times would have contacts in Los Angeles and Miami send cargo to Honduras, where the authorities were cooperating with the Contras. Pina believed Menezes had contact with Bermudez from about 1981 or 1982 through the mid-1980s. Bromwich's report then added, Pina said he was one of the couriers Menezes used to deliver drug money to a Colombian known as Carlos in Los Angeles and returned to San Francisco with cocaine. Pina made 6 to 8 trips, with anywhere from $600,000 to nearly $1 million, and brought back 6 to 8 kilos of cocaine each time. Pina said Menezes was moving hundreds of kilos a week. Carlos once told Pina, "We're helping your cause with this drug thing. We are helping your organization a lot." Ainsworth also said he tried to alert Oliver North in 1985 about the troubling connections between the Contra movement and cocaine traffickers, but that North turned a deaf ear. "In the spring, some friends of mine and I went back to the White House staff, but we were put off by Ollie North and others on the staff who really don't want to know all what's going on," Ainsworth told Russoniello. "When I first spoke with Ainsworth in September 1985 at a coffee shop in San Francisco, he asked for confidentiality, which I granted. However, since the documents released by the National Archives include him describing his conversations with me, that confidentiality no longer applies." Ainsworth also spoke with Webb for his 1996 San Jose Mercury News series under the pseudonym David Morrison. "Though I found Ainsworth to be generally reliable, some of his depictions of our conversations contained mild exaggerations or confusion over details, such as his claim that I called him from Costa Rica in January 1986 and told him that the Contra cocaine story that I had been working on with my AP colleague Brian Barger never hit the papers because it was suppressed by the Associated Press due to political pressure primarily from the CIA. In reality, Barger and I returned from Costa Rica in fall 1985, wrote our story about the Contras' involvement in cocaine smuggling, and pushed it onto the AP wire in December, though in a reduced form because of resistance from some senior AP news executives who were supportive of President Reagan's foreign policies. The CIA, the White House and other agencies of the Reagan administration did seek to discredit our story, but they did not prevent its publication. An overriding hostility, the Reagan administration's neglect of Ainsworth's insights reflected the overriding hostility toward any information, even from a Republican activist like Ainsworth, that put the Contras in a negative light. In early 1987, when Ainsworth spoke with the United States Attorney Russoniello and the FBI, the Reagan administration was in full damage control mode, trying to tamp down the Iran-Contra disclosures about Oliver North diverting profits from secret arms sales to Iran to the Contra war. Fears that the Iran-Contra scandal could lead to Reagan's impeachment made it even less likely that the Justice Department would pursue an investigation into drug ties implicating the Contra leadership. Ainsworth's information was simply passed on to independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, whose inquiry was already overwhelmed by the task of sorting out the convoluted Iran transactions. Publicly, the Reagan team continued dumping on the Contra cocaine allegations and playing the find any possible reason to reject a witness game. The major news media went along, leading to much mainstream ridicule of a 1989 investigative report by Senator John Kerry, D. Massachusetts, who uncovered more drug connections implicating the Contras and the Reagan administration. Only occasionally, such as when the George H. W. Bush administration needed witnesses to convict Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, did the Contra cocaine evidence pop onto official Washington's radar. During Noriega's drug trafficking trial in 1991, the United States prosecutors called as a witness Colombian Medellin cartel kingpin Carlos Leder, who, along with implicating Noriega, testified that the cartel had given $10 million to the Contras, an allegation first unearthed by Senator Kerry. The Kerry hearings didn't get the attention they deserved at the time. A Washington Post editorial on November 27, 1991, acknowledged. The Noriega trial brings this sordid aspect of the Nicaraguan engagement to fresh public attention. But the Post offered its readers no explanation for why Kerry's hearings had been largely ignored, with the Post itself a leading culprit in this journalistic misfeasance. Nor did the Post and the other leading newspapers use the opening created by the Noriega trial to do anything to rectify their past neglect. Everything quickly returned to the status quo, in which the desired perception of the noble Contras trumped the clear reality of their criminal activities. Instead of recognizing the skewed moral compass of the Reagan administration, Congress was soon falling over itself to attach Reagan's name to as many public buildings and facilities as possible, including Washington's National Airport. Meanwhile, those of us in journalism who had exposed the national security crimes of the 1980s saw our careers mostly sink or go sideways. We were regarded as pariahs in our profession. As for me, shortly after the Iran-Contra scandal broke wide open in fall 1986, I accepted a job at Newsweek, one of the many mainstream news outlets that had long ignored Contra-connected scandals and briefly thought it needed to bolster its coverage. But I soon discovered that senior editors remained hostile toward the Iran-Contra story and related spin-off scandals, including the Contra cocaine mess. After losing battle after battle with my Newsweek editors, I departed the magazine in June 1990 to write a book, called Fooling America, about the decline of the Washington Press Corps and the parallel rise of a new generation of government propagandists. I was also hired by PBS Frontline to investigate whether there had been a prequel to the Iran-Contra scandal, whether those arms for hostage deals in the mid-1980s had been preceded by contacts between Reagan's 1980 campaign staff and Iran, which was then holding 52 Americans hostage and essentially destroying Jimmy Carter's re-election hopes. For more on that topic, see Robert Perry's Secrecy and Privilege and America's Stolen Narrative. Finding New Ways in 1995, frustrated by the growing triviality of American journalism, and acting on the advice of and with the assistance of my oldest son Sam, I turned to a new medium and launched the Internet's first investigative news magazine, known as ConsortiumNews.com. The website became a way for me to put out well-reported stories that my former mainstream colleagues ignored or mocked. So, when Gary Webb called me in 1996 to talk about his upcoming series reviving the Contra Cocaine story, I explained some of this tortured history and urged him to make sure that his editors were firmly behind him. He sounded perplexed at my advice and assured me that he had the solid support of his editors. When Webb's Dark Alliance series finally appeared in late August 1996, it initially drew little attention. The major national news outlets applied their usual studied indifference to a topic that they had already judged unworthy of serious attention. But Webb's story proved hard to ignore. First, unlike the work that Barger and I did for AP in the mid-1980s, Webb's series wasn't just a story about drug traffickers in Central America and their protectors in Washington. It was about the on-the-ground consequences, inside the United States, of that drug trafficking, how the lives of Americans were blighted and destroyed as the collateral damage of the United States foreign policy initiative. In other words, there were real-life American victims, and they were concentrated in African-American communities. That meant the ever-sensitive issue of race had been injected into the controversy. Anger from black communities spread quickly to the Congressional Black Caucus, which started demanding answers. Secondly, the San Jose Mercury News, which was the local newspaper for Silicon Valley, had posted documents and audio on its state-of-the-art internet site. That way, readers could examine much of the documentary support for the series. It also meant that the traditional gatekeeper role of the major newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times, was under assault. If a regional paper like the Mercury News could finance a major journalistic investigation like this one, and circumvent the judgments of the editorial boards at the Big Three, then there might be a tectonic shift in the power relations of the United States news media. There could be a breakdown of the established order. This combination of factors led to the next phase of the Contra Cocaine battle, the Get Gary Webb counterattack. Soon, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Los Angeles Times were lining up like some tag team wrestlers taking turns pummeling Webb and his story. On October 4, 1996, the Washington Post published a front-page article knocking down Webb's series, although acknowledging that some Contra operatives did help the cocaine cartels. The Post's approach fit with the big media's cognitive dissonance on the topic. First, the Post called the Contra cocaine allegations old news. Even CIA personnel testified to Congress they knew that those covered operations involved drug traffickers, the Post said, and second, the Post minimized the importance of the one Contra smuggling channel that Webb had highlighted in his series, saying it had not played a major role in the emergence of crack. To add to the smug hoo-ha treatment that was enveloping Webb and his story, the Post published a sidebar story dismissing African Americans as prone to conspiracy fears. Next, the New York Times and Los Angeles Times weighed in with lengthy articles castigating Webb and Dark Alliance. The big newspapers made much of the CIA's internal reviews in 1987 and 1988, almost a decade earlier, that supposedly had cleared the spy agency of any role in contracocaine smuggling. But the first ominous sign for the CIA's cover-up emerged on October 24, 1996, when CIA Inspector General Frederick Hitz conceded before the Senate Intelligence Committee that the first CIA probe had lasted only 12 days, and the second only 3 days. He promised a more thorough review. Mocking Webb, but Webb had already crossed over from being treated as a serious journalist to becoming a target of ridicule. Influential Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz mocked Webb for saying in a book proposal that he would explore the possibility that the Contra war was primarily a business to its participants. Oliver Stone, check your voicemail, Kurtz smirked. Yet, Webb's suspicion was no conspiracy theory. Indeed, Oliver North's chief Contra emissary, Rob Owen, had made the same point in a March 17, 1986 message about the Contra leadership. Few of the so-called leaders of the movement really care about the boys in the field, Owen wrote. This war has become a business to many of them. Emphasis in original. Ainsworth and other pro-Contra activists were reaching the same conclusion, that the Contra leadership was scheming money from the supply lines and padding their personal wealth with proceeds from the drug trade. According to a January 21, 1987 interview report by the FBI, Ainsworth said he had made inquiries in the local San Francisco Nicaraguan community and wondered among his acquaintances what Adolfo Calero and the other people in the FDN movement were doing, and the word that he received back is that they were probably engaged in cocaine smuggling. In other words, Webb was right about the suspicion that the Contra movement had become less a cause than a business to many of its participants. Even Oliver North's emissary reported on that reality. But truthfulness had ceased to be relevant in the media's hazing of Gary Webb. In another double standard, while Webb was held to the strictest standards of journalism, it was entirely all right for Kurtz, the supposed arbiter of journalistic integrity who was a longtime fixture on CNN's reliable sources, to make judgments based on ignorance. Kurtz would face no repercussions for mocking a fellow journalist who was factually correct. The Big Three's assault, combined with their disparaging tone, had a predictable effect on the executives of the Mercury News. As it turned out, Webb's confidence in his editors had been misplaced. By early 1997, executive editor Jerry Seppos, who had his own corporate career to worry about, was in retreat. On May 11, 1997, Seppos published a front-page column saying the series fell short of my standards. He criticized the stories because they strongly implied CIA knowledge of Contra connections to the United States drug dealers who were manufacturing crack cocaine. We did not have enough proof that top CIA officials knew of the relationship, Seppos wrote. Seppos was wrong about the proof, of course. At AP, before we published our first contracocaine article in 1985, Barger and I had known that the CIA and Reagan's White House were aware of the contracocaine problem at senior levels. One of our sources was on Reagan's National Security Council staff. However, Seppos recognized that he and his newspaper were facing a credibility crisis brought on by the harsh consensus delivered by the Big Three, a judgment that had quickly solidified into conventional wisdom throughout the major news media and inside Knight Ridder, Inc., which owned the Mercury News. The only career-saving move, career-saving for Seppos, even if career-destroying for Webb, was to jettison Webb and the Contra-Cocaine investigative project. A vindication. The big newspapers and the Contra's defenders celebrated Seppos's retreat as vindication of their own dismissal of the Contra-Cocaine stories. In particular, Kurtz seemed proud that his demeaning of Webb now had the endorsement of Webb's editor. Seppos next pulled the plug on the Mercury News continuing Contra-Cocaine investigation and reassigned Webb to a small office in Cupertino, California, far from his family. Webb resigned from the paper in disgrace. See consortiumnews.com's Hung Out to Dry. For undercutting Webb and other Mercury News reporters working on the Contra-Cocaine project, some of whom were facing personal danger in Central America, Seppos was lauded by the American Journalism Review and received the 1997 National Ethics in Journalism Award by the Society of Professional Journalists. While Seppos won raves, Webb watched his career collapse and his marriage break up. Still, Gary Webb had set in motion internal government investigations that would bring to the surface long-hidden facts about how the Reagan administration had conducted the Contra War. The CIA published the first part of Inspector General Hitz's findings on January 29, 1998. Though the CIA's press release for the report criticized Webb and defended the CIA, Hitz's Volume 1 admitted that not only were many of Webb's allegations true, but that he actually understated the seriousness of the Contra drug crimes and the CIA's knowledge of them. Hitz conceded that cocaine smugglers played a significant early role in the Contra movement and that the CIA intervened to block an image-threatening 1984 federal investigation into a San Francisco-based drug ring with suspected ties to the Contras, the so-called Frogman case. After Volume 1 was released, I called Webb, whom I had spent some time with since his series was published. I chided him for indeed getting the story wrong. He had understated how serious the problem of contra-cocaine trafficking had been, I said. It was a form of gallows humor for the two of us, since nothing had changed in the way the major newspapers treated the contra-cocaine issue. They focused only on the press release that continued to attack Webb, while ignoring the incriminating information that could be found in the full report. All I could do was highlight those admissions at consortiumnews.com, which sadly had a much, much smaller readership than the Big Three. The United States news media also looked the other way on other startling disclosures. On May 7, 1998, for instance, Representative Maxine Waters, a California Democrat, introduced into the Congressional Record a February 11, 1982 letter of understanding between the CIA and the Justice Department. The letter, which had been requested by CIA Director William Casey, freed the CIA from legal requirements that it must report drug smuggling by CIA assets, a provision that covered the Nicaraguan Contras and the Afghan Mujahideen. In other words, early in those two covert wars, the CIA leadership wanted to make sure that its geopolitical objectives would not be complicated by a legal requirement to turn in its client forces for drug trafficking. Justice denied. The next break in the long-running contra-cocaine cover-up was a report by the Justice Department's Inspector General Michael Bromwich. Given the hostile climate surrounding Webb's series, Bromwich's report also opened with criticism of Webb. But, like the CIA's Volume 1, The contents revealed new details about serious government wrongdoing. According to evidence cited by Bromwich, the Reagan administration knew almost from the outset of the Contra War that cocaine traffickers permeated the paramilitary operation. The administration also did next to nothing to expose or stop the crimes. Bromwich's report revealed example after example of leads not followed, corroborated witnesses disparaged, official law enforcement investigations sabotaged, and even the CIA facilitating the work of drug traffickers. The report showed that the Contras and their supporters ran several parallel drug smuggling operations, not just the one at the center of Webb series. The report also found that the CIA shared little of its information about Contra drugs with law enforcement agencies and on three occasions disrupted cocaine trafficking investigations that threatened the Contras. As well as depicting a more widespread Contra drug operation than Webb, or Barger and I, had understood, the Justice Department report provided some important corroboration about Nicaraguan drug smuggler Norwin Menezes, a key figure in Gary Webb's series and Adolfo Calero's friend as described by Dennis Ainsworth. Bromwich cited the United States government informants who supplied detailed information about Menezes's drug operation and his financial assistance to the Contras. For instance, Renato Pina, the money and drug courier for Menezes, said that in the early 1980s the CIA allowed the Contras to fly drugs into the United States, sell them, and keep the proceeds. Pina, the FDN's Northern California representative, said the drug trafficking was forced on the Contras by the inadequate levels of the United States government assistance. The Justice Department report also disclosed repeated examples of the CIA and the United States embassies in Central America discouraging DEA investigations, including one into Contra cocaine shipments moving through the international airport in El Salvador. Bromwich said secrecy trumped all. We have no doubt that the CIA and the United States Embassy were not anxious for the DEA to pursue its investigation at the airport, he wrote. Bromwich also described the curious case of how a DEA pilot helped a CIA asset escape from Costa Rican authorities in 1989 after the man, American farmer John Hull, had been charged in connection with Contra cocaine trafficking. Hull's ranch in northern Costa Rica had been the site of Contra camps for attacking Nicaragua from the south. For years, Contra-connected witnesses also said Hull's property was used for the transshipment of cocaine en route to the United States, but those accounts were brushed aside by the Reagan administration and disparaged in major the United States newspapers. Yet, according to Bromwich's report, the DEA took the accounts seriously enough to prepare a research report on the evidence in November 1986. One informant described Colombian cocaine offloaded at an airstrip on Hull's ranch. The drugs were then concealed in a shipment of frozen shrimp and transported to the United States. The alleged Costa Rican shipper was Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas, a firm controlled by Cuban-American Luis Rodriguez. Like Hull, however, Frigoríficos had friends in high places. In 1985-86, the State Department had selected the shrimp company to handle $261,937 in non-lethal assistance earmarked for the Contras. Hull also remained a man with powerful protectors. Even after Costa Rican authorities brought drug charges against him, influential Americans, including Representative Lee Hamilton, D. Indiana, demanded that Hull be let out of jail pending trial. Then, in July 1989 with the help of a DEA pilot and possibly a DEA agent as well. Hull managed to fly out of Costa Rica to Haiti and then to the United States. Despite these startling new disclosures, the big newspapers still showed no inclination to read beyond the criticism of Webb in the press release. Major disclosures. By fall 1998, Washington was obsessed with President Bill Clinton's Monica Lewinsky sex scandal, which made it easier to ignore even more stunning contra-cocaine disclosures in the CIA's Volume 2, published on October 8, 1998. In the report, CIA Inspector General Hitz identified more than 50 Contras and Contra-related entities implicated in the drug trade. He also detailed how the Reagan administration had protected these drug operations and frustrated federal investigations throughout the 1980s. According to Volume 2, the CIA knew the criminal nature of its Contra clients from the start of the war against Nicaragua's leftist Sandinista government. The earliest Contra force, called the Nicaraguan Revolutionary Democratic Alliance, ADRAN, or the 15th of September Legion, had chosen to stoop to criminal activities in order to feed and clothe their cadre, according to a June 1981 draft of a CIA field report. According to a September 1981 cable to CIA headquarters, two ADRAN members made the first delivery of drugs to Miami in July 1981. ADRAN's leaders included Enrique Bermudez and other early Contras who would later direct the major Contra army. The CIA-organized FDN, which was based in Honduras, along Nicaragua's northern border. Throughout the war, Bermudez remained the top Contra military commander. The CIA later corroborated the allegations about ADRAN's cocaine trafficking, but insisted that Bermudez had opposed the drug shipments to the United States that went ahead nonetheless. The truth about Bermudez's supposed objections to drug trafficking, however, was less clear. According to Hitz's Volume 1, Bermudez enlisted Norwin Menezes, the Nicaraguan cocaine smuggler, the friend of Adolfo Calero, and a key figure in Webb's series to raise money and buy supplies for the Contras. Volume 1 had quoted another Nicaraguan trafficker, Danilo Blandon, a Menezes associate, and another lead character in Webb's series, as telling Hitz's investigators that he, Blandon, and Menezes flew to Honduras to meet with Bermudez in 1982. At the time, Menezes's criminal activities were well known in the Nicaraguan exile community, but Bermudez told the cocaine smugglers that the ends justify the means in raising money for the Contras. After the Bermudez meeting, Menezes and Blandon were briefly arrested by Honduran police, who confiscated $100,000 that the police suspected was to be a payment for a drug transaction. The Contras intervened, gained freedom for the two traffickers, and got them their money back by saying the cash, which indeed was for a cocaine purchase in Bolivia, belonged to the Contras. There were other indications of Bermudez's drug smuggling complicity. In February 1988, another Nicaraguan exile linked to the drug trade accused Bermudez of participation in narcotics trafficking, according to Hitz's report. After the Contra War ended, Bermudez returned to Managua, Nicaragua, where he was shot to death on February 16, 1991. The murder has never been solved. The Southern Front. Along the Southern Front, the Contras' military operations in Costa Rica on Nicaragua's southern border, the CIA's drug evidence centered on the forces of Eden Pastora, another top Contra commander. But Hitz discovered that the United States government may have made the drug situation worse, not better. Hitz revealed that the CIA put an admitted drug operative, known by his CIA pseudonym Yvonne Gomez, in a supervisory position over Pastora. Hitz reported that the CIA discovered Gomez's drug history in 1987 when Gomez failed a security review on drug trafficking questions. In internal CIA interviews, Gomez admitted that in March or April 1982, he helped family members who were engaged in drug trafficking and money laundering. In one case, Gomez said he assisted his brother and brother-in-law transporting cash from New York City to Miami. He admitted he knew this act was illegal. Later, Gomez expanded on his admission, describing how his family members had fallen $2 million into debt and had gone to Miami to run a money laundering center for drug traffickers. Gomez said his brother had many visitors whom Gomez assumed to be in the drug trafficking business. Gomez's brother was arrested on drug charges in June 1982. 3 months later, in September 1982, Gomez started his CIA assignment in Costa Rica. Years later, convicted drug trafficker Carlos Cabezas alleged that in the early 1980s, Yvonne Gomez was the CIA agent in Costa Rica who was overseeing drug money donations to the Contras. Gomez was to make sure the money was given to the right people, the Contras, and nobody was taking profit they weren't supposed to, Cabezas stated publicly. But the CIA sought to discredit Cabezas at the time because he had trouble identifying Gomez's picture and put Gomez at one meeting in early 1982 before Gomez started his CIA assignment. While the CIA was able to fend off Cabezas's allegations by pointing to these minor discrepancies, Hitz's report revealed that the CIA was nevertheless aware of Gomez's direct role in drug money laundering, a fact the agency hid from Senator Kerry in his investigation during the late 1980s. There was also more to know about Gomez. In November 1985, the FBI learned from an informant that Gomez's two brothers had been large-scale cocaine importers, with one brother arranging shipments from Bolivia's infamous drug kingpin Roberto Suarez. Suarez already was known as a financier of right-wing causes. In 1980, with the support of Argentina's hardline anti-communist military regime, Suarez bankrolled a coup in Bolivia that ousted the elected left-of-center government. The violent putsch became known as the cocaine coup because it made Bolivia the region's first narco-state. By protecting cocaine shipments headed north, Bolivia's government helped transform Colombia's Medellin cartel from a struggling local operation into a giant corporate-style business for delivering vast quantities of cocaine to the United States market. Flush with cash in the early 1980s, Suarez invested more than $30 million in various right-wing paramilitary operations, including the Contra forces in Central America, according to the United States Senate testimony by an Argentine intelligence officer, Leonardo Sanchez Riaza. In 1987, Sanchez Riaza said the Suarez drug money was laundered through front companies in Miami before going to Central America. There, other Argentine intelligence officers, veterans of the Bolivian coup, trained the Contras in the early 1980s, even before the CIA arrived to first assist with the training and later take over the Contra operation from the Argentines. Inspector General Hitz added another piece to the mystery of the Bolivian Contra connection. One Contra fundraiser, Jose Orlando Bolanos, boasted that the Argentine government was supporting his Contra activities, according to a May 1982 cable to CIA headquarters. Bolanos made the statement during a meeting with undercover DEA agents in Florida. He even offered to introduce them to his Bolivian cocaine supplier. Despite all this suspicious drug activity centered around Ivan Gomez and the Contras, the CIA insisted that it did not unmask Gomez until 1987, when he failed a security check and confessed his role in his family's drug business. The CIA official who interviewed Gomez concluded that Gomez directly participated in illegal drug transactions, concealed participation in illegal drug transactions, and concealed information about involvement in illegal drug activity, Hitz wrote. But senior CIA officials still protected Gomez. They refused to refer the Gomez case to the Justice Department, citing the 1982 agreement that spared the CIA from a legal obligation to report narcotics crimes by people collaborating with the CIA who were not formal agency employees. Gomez was an independent contractor who worked for the CIA but was not officially on staff. The CIA eased Gomez out of the agency in February 1988, without alerting law enforcement or the congressional oversight committees. When questioned about the case nearly a decade later, one senior CIA official who had supported the gentle treatment of Gomez had second thoughts. "It is a striking commentary on me and everyone that this guy's involvement in narcotics didn't weigh more heavily on me or the system," the official told Hitz's investigators. Drug path to the White House. A Medellin drug connection arose in another section of Hitz's report, when he revealed evidence suggesting that some Contra trafficking may have been sanctioned by Reagan's National Security Council. The protagonist for this part of the Contra cocaine mystery was Moises Núñez, a Cuban-American who worked for Oliver North's NSC Contra support operation and for two drug-connected seafood importers, Ocean Hunter in Miami and Frigoríficos de Puntarenas in Costa Rica. Frigoríficos de Puntarenas was created in the early 1980s as a cover for drug money laundering, according to sworn testimony by two of the firm's principals, Carlos Soto, and Medellin cartel accountant Ramon Millán Rodríguez. It was also the company implicated by a DEA informant in moving cocaine from John Hull's ranch to the United States. Drug allegations were swirling around Moises Núñez by the mid-1980s. Indeed, his operation was one of the targets of my and Barga's AP investigation in 1985. Finally reacting to the suspicions, the CIA questioned Núñez about his alleged cocaine trafficking on March 25, 1987. He responded by pointing the finger at his NSC superiors. Núñez revealed that since 1985, he had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council, Hitz reported, adding, Núñez refused to elaborate on the nature of these actions, but indicated it was difficult to answer questions relating to his involvement in narcotics trafficking because of the specific tasks he had performed at the direction of the NSC. Núñez refused to identify the NSC officials with whom he had been involved. After this first round of questioning, CIA headquarters authorized an additional session, but then senior CIA officials reversed the decision. There would be no further efforts at debriefing Núñez. Hitz noted that the cable from headquarters offered no explanation for the decision to stop the Núñez interrogation. But the CIA's Central American Task Force Chief Alan Fiers Jr. said the Núñez NSC drug lead was not pursued because of the NSC connection and the possibility that this could be somehow connected to the private benefactor program the Contra money handled by the NSC's Oliver North. A decision was made not to pursue this matter. Joseph Fernandez, who had been the CIA's station chief in Costa Rica, confirmed to congressional Iran-Contra investigators that Núñez was involved in a very sensitive operation for North's enterprise. The exact nature of that NSC-authorized activity has never been divulged. At the time of the Nunez NSC drug admissions and his truncated interrogation, the CIA's acting director was Robert Gates, who nearly two decades later became President George W. Bush's second Secretary of Defense, a position he retained under President Barack Obama. Drug record: the CIA also worked directly with other drug-connected Cuban Americans on the Contra Project, hits found. One of Nunez's Cuban American associates, Felipe Vidal, had a criminal record as a narcotics trafficker in the 1970s. But the CIA still hired him to serve as a logistics coordinator for the Contras, hits reported. The CIA also learned that Vidal's drug connections were not only in the past. A December 1984 cable to CIA headquarters revealed Vidal's ties to René Corvo, another Cuban-American suspected of drug trafficking. Corvo was working with Cuban anti-communist Frank Castro, who was viewed as a Medellin cartel representative within the Contra movement. There were other narcotics links to Vidal. In January 1986, the DEA in Miami seized 414 pounds of cocaine concealed in a shipment of yucca that was going from a Contra operative in Costa Rica to Ocean Hunter, the company where Vidal and Moises Nunez worked. Despite the evidence, Vidal remained a CIA employee as he collaborated with Frank Castro's assistant, René Corvo, in raising money for the Contras, according to a CIA memo in June 1986. By fall 1986, Senator Kerry had heard enough rumors about Vidal to demand information about him as part of his congressional inquiry into Contra drugs. But the CIA withheld the derogatory information in its files. On October 15, 1986, Kerry received a briefing from the CIA's Alan Fears, who didn't mention Vidal's drug arrests and conviction in the 1970s. But Vidal was not yet in the clear. In 1987, the United States Attorney's Office in Miami began investigating Vidal, Ocean Hunter, and other Contra-connected entities. This prosecutorial attention worried the CIA. The CIA's Latin American division felt it was time for a security review of Vidal. But on August 5, 1987, the CIA's security office blocked the review for fear that the Vidal drug information could be exposed during any future litigation. As expected, the United States Attorney's Office did request documents about Contra-related activities by Vidal, Ocean Hunter, and 16 other entities. The CIA advised the prosecutor that no information had been found regarding Ocean Hunter, a statement that was clearly false. The CIA continued Vidal's employment as an advisor to the Contra movement until 1990, virtually the end of the Contra War. Hits also revealed that drugs tainted the highest levels of the Honduran-based FDN, the largest Contra army. Hits found that Juan Rivas, a Contra commander who rose to be chief of staff, admitted that he had been a cocaine trafficker in Colombia before the war. The CIA asked Rivas, known as El Quiche, about his background after the DEA began suspecting that Rivas might be an escaped convict from a Colombian prison. In interviews with CIA officers, Rivas acknowledged that he had been arrested and convicted of packaging and transporting cocaine for the drug trade in Barranquilla, Colombia. After several months in prison, Rivas said, he escaped and moved to Central America, where he joined the Contras. Defending Rivas, CIA officials insisted that there was no evidence that Rivas engaged in trafficking while with the Contras. but one CIA cable noted that he lived an expensive lifestyle, even keeping a $100,000 thoroughbred horse at the Contra camp. Contra military commander Bermudez later attributed Rivas's wealth to his ex-girlfriend's rich family. But a CIA cable in March 1989 added that some in the FDN may have suspected at the time that the father-in-law was engaged in drug trafficking. Still, the CIA...
And that is the end of Part A, and I'm going to finish up with Part B, which is not near as long, but this is tremendous information, especially when we hear all the time America is going to be great again. America's not going to be great again. It's a failed empire, and it's over. It's not going to be great again. In fact, I begin to question, after being a real student of history, whether it was ever great. Powerful, yes. Great, no.
I moved quickly to protect Rivas from exposure and possible extradition to Colombia. In February 1989, CIA headquarters asked that the DEA take no action in view of the serious political damage to the United States government that could occur should the information about Rivas become public. Of poor health. With the United States government help, he was allowed to resettle in Miami. Colombia was not informed about his fugitive status. Another senior FDN official implicated in the drug trade was its chief spokesman in Honduras, Arnaldo José Frank Arana. The drug allegations against Arana dated back to 1983, when a federal narcotics task force put him under criminal investigation because of plans to smuggle 100 kilograms of cocaine into the United States from South America. On January 23, 1986, the FBI reported that Arana and his brothers were involved in a drug smuggling enterprise, although Arana was not charged. Arana sought to clear up another set of drug suspicions in 1989 by visiting the DEA in Honduras with a business associate, José Pérez. Arana's association with Pérez, however, only raised new alarms. If Arana is mixed up with the Pérez brothers, he is probably dirty, the DEA said. Drug airlines, through their ownership of an air services company called Setco, the Pérez brothers were associated with Juan Mata Ballesteros, a major cocaine kingpin connected to the 1985 torture murder of DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena, according to reports by the DEA and the United States Customs. Hits reported that someone at the CIA scribbled a note on a DEA cable about Arana stating, "Arnold Arana. Still active and working, we CIA may have a problem." Despite its drug ties to Mata Ballesteros, Setco emerged as the principal company for ferrying supplies to the Contras in Honduras. During congressional Iran-Contra hearings, FDN political leader Adolfo Calero testified that Setco was paid from bank accounts controlled by Oliver North. Setco also received $185,924 from the State Department for delivering supplies to the Contras in 1986. Furthermore, Hits found that other air transport companies used by the Contras were implicated in the cocaine trade as well. Even FDN leaders suspected that they were shipping supplies to Central America aboard planes that might be returning with drugs. Mario Calero, Adolfo Calero's brother and the chief of Contra Logistics, grew so uneasy about one air freight company that he notified the United States law enforcement that the FDN only chartered the planes for the flights south, not the return flights north. Hits found that some drug pilots simply rotated from one sector of the Contra operation to another. Donaldo Frixon, who had a drug record in the Dominican Republic, was hired by the CIA to fly Contra missions from 1983 to 1985. In September 1986, however, Frixon was implicated in smuggling 19,000 pounds of marijuana into the United States. In late 1986 or early 1987, he went to work for Vortex, another U.S. paid Contra supply company linked to the drug trade. By the time that Hitz's Volume 2 was published in fall 1998, the CIA's defense against Webb series had shrunk to a fig leaf, that the CIA did not conspire with the Contras to raise money through cocaine trafficking. But Hitz made clear that the Contra war took precedence over law enforcement and that the CIA withheld evidence of Contra crimes from the Justice Department, Congress, and even the CIA's own analytical division. Besides tracing the evidence of Contra drug trafficking through the decade-long Contra war, the Inspector General interviewed senior CIA officers who acknowledged that they were aware of the Contra drug problem but didn't want its exposure to undermine the struggle to overthrow Nicaragua's leftist Sandinista government. According to Hitz, the CIA had one overriding priority, to oust the Sandinista government. CIA officers were determined that the various difficulties they encountered not be allowed to prevent effective implementation of the Contra program. One CIA field officer explained, "The focus was to get the job done, get the support and win the war." Hitz also recounted complaints from CIA analysts that CIA operations officers handling the Contras hid evidence of Contra drug trafficking even from the CIA's analysts. Because of the withheld evidence, the CIA analysts incorrectly concluded in the mid-1980s that only a handful of Contras might have been involved in drug trafficking. That false assessment was passed on to Congress and to major news organizations, serving as an important basis for denouncing Gary Webb and his Dark Alliance series in 1996. CIA admission. Although Hitz's report was an extraordinary admission of institutional guilt by the CIA, it went almost unnoticed by the big American newspapers. On October 10, 1998, 2 days after Hitz's Volume 2 was posted on the CIA's website, the New York Times published a brief article that continued to deride Webb but acknowledged the Contra drug problem may have been worse than earlier understood. Several weeks later, the Washington Post weighed in with a story that simply missed the point of the CIA's confession. Though having assigned 17 journalists to tear down Webb's reporting, the Los Angeles Times chose not to publish a story on the release of Hitz's Volume 2. In 2000, the House Intelligence Committee grudgingly acknowledged that the stories about Reagan's CIA protecting Contra drug traffickers were true. The committee released a report citing classified testimony from CIA Inspector General Britt Snyder, Hitz's successor, admitting that the spy agency had turned a blind eye to evidence of Contra drug smuggling and generally treated drug smuggling through Central America as a low priority. In the end, the objective of unseating the Sandinistas appears to have taken precedence over dealing properly with potentially serious allegations against those with whom the agency was working, Snyder said, adding that the CIA did not treat the drug allegations in a consistent, reasoned or justifiable manner. The House committee, then controlled by Republicans, still downplayed the significance of the Contra cocaine scandal, but the panel acknowledged, deep inside its report, that in some cases, CIA employees did nothing to verify or disprove drug trafficking information, even when they had the opportunity to do so. In some of these, receipt of a drug allegation appeared to provoke no specific response, and business went on as usual. Like the release of Hitz's report in 1998, the admissions by Snyder and the House committee drew virtually no media attention in 2000, except for a few articles on the Internet, including one at consortiumnews.com. Because of this journalistic misconduct by the big three newspapers, choosing to conceal their own neglect of the Contra cocaine scandal and to protect the Reagan administration's image, Webb's reputation was never rehabilitated. After his original Dark Alliance series was published in 1996, I joined Webb in a few speaking appearances on the West Coast, including one packed book talk at the Midnight Special bookstore in Santa Monica, California. For a time, Webb was treated as a celebrity on the American left, but that gradually faded. In our interactions during these joint appearances, I found Webb to be a regular guy who seemed to be holding up fairly well under the terrible pressure. He had landed an investigative job with a California state legislative committee. He also felt some measure of vindication when CIA Inspector General Hitz's reports came out. But Webb never could overcome the pain caused by his betrayal at the hands of his journalistic colleagues, his peers. In the years that followed, Webb was unable to find decent paying work in his profession. The conventional wisdom remained that he had somehow been exposed as a journalistic fraud. His state job ended, his marriage fell apart, he struggled to pay bills, and he was faced with a forced move out of a house near Sacramento, California, and in with his mother. On December 9, 2004, the 49-year-old Webb typed out suicide notes to his ex-wife and his three children, laid out a certificate for his cremation, and taped a note on the door telling movers, who were coming the next morning, to instead call 911. Webb then took out his father's pistol and shot himself in the head. The first shot was not lethal, so he fired once more. Even with Webb's death, the big newspapers that had played key roles in his destruction couldn't bring themselves to show Webb any mercy. After Webb's body was found, I received a call from a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who knew that I was one of Webb's few journalistic colleagues who had defended him and his work. I told the reporter that American history owed a great debt to Gary Webb because he had forced out important facts about Reagan-era crimes. But I added that the Los Angeles Times would be hard-pressed to write an honest obituary because the newspaper had ignored Hitz's final report, which had largely vindicated Webb. To my disappointment but not my surprise, I was correct. The Los Angeles Times ran a mean-spirited obituary that made no mention of either my defense of Webb, nor the CIA's admissions in 1998. The obituary was republished in other newspapers, including the Washington Post. In effect, Webb's suicide enabled senior editors at the big three newspapers to breathe a little easier. One of the few people who understood the ugly story of the Reagan administration's cover-up of the Contra cocaine scandal and the United States media's complicity was now silenced. To this day, none of the journalists or media critics who participated in the destruction of Gary Webb has paid a price. None has faced the sort of humiliation that Webb had to endure. None had to experience that special pain of standing up for what is best in the profession of journalism, taking on a difficult story that seeks to hold powerful people accountable for serious crimes, and then being vilified by your own colleagues, the people that you expected to understand and appreciate what you had done. On the contrary, many were rewarded with professional advancement and lucrative careers. For instance, for years, Howard Kurtz got to host the CNN program, Reliable Sources, which lectured journalists on professional standards. He was described in the program's bio as the nation's premier media critic. His show later moved to Fox News, renamed MediaBuzz. But the web tragedy and the Contra-Cocaine case remain relevant today because they underscore how the mainstream press cannot be trusted with decisions about what news is true and what is false. If such a ministry of truth had existed in the late 1990s, the dark chapter of the Reagan administration's dealings with Nicaraguan drug traffickers would still be just a vague and easily dismissed rumor. Ted Gunderson, retired FBI expert in analyzing and reconstructing crime scenes. On December 1, 2005, I spoke with Ted Gunderson about Webb's death. Mr. Gunderson is a retired FBI agent who enjoyed a distinguished career with the FBI that spanned 27-plus years. Prior to his retirement in 1979, Mr. Gunderson was a senior special agent in charge with a $22 million annual budget at his disposal and over 700 persons under his charge. Mr. Gunderson told me, "My expertise is analyzing and reconstructing crime scenes." He said, "Gary Webb was murdered. He, Webb, resisted the first shot to the head that exited via jaw, so he was shot again with the second shot going into the head brain." I asked Mr. Gunderson what he thought about the two shots to the head suicide theory that posits Webb simply missed his brain with the first shot, so he had to shoot himself again, this time successfully hitting the brain with a .38 revolver? Without hesitation, Gunderson exclaimed, "Impossible."
Well, as you may know as I do, the Republic died a long time ago. But now the Empire is dying too, and it's getting more corrupt as time goes by. The corruption is so deep in this country and among the ruling class and the wealthy that it's indescribable. Assassinations go on all the time under the cover of so-called suicides. So when Donald Trump talks about making America great again, it's not going to happen. It's too corrupt. Now, this is going to be available on our website where you can download it. We'll put the address up there. There was a little bit of a glitch there when I went to the second part because sometimes I forget to unplug my microphone. But you get the gist of it. And like I say, you can download it from our website once we get it up there. So that's it for today, boys and girls. I hate to rain on your parade, but I've been raining on your parade for a long time, and I guess I haven't hit a nerve hard enough because I'm still around. Okay, boys and girls, see you on Moonsday, 14-5. Never trust a leader, president, king, dictator, or whatever. Don't ever trust a politician. They all lie.